now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
A city that emerged from the alluvial plain of Sumer about 6,000 years ago or thereabouts is going to play a key role in your future. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. I'm talking, of course, about the city known as Babylon. There may have been, certainly was more than one city named Babylon, and we'll talk about the differences between the Babylon of history and the Babylon of the future with our guest, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated investigative journalist, co-author of the book The Babylon Code with Paul McGuire. We welcome Troy Anderson to the program. Troy, Babylon is mentioned in the Bible so often. It is, at least in the Old Testament, it almost seems that parts of the Bible are devoted to the history of the Babylonians as much as to the Hebrews.
It turns out that Babylon is the second most mentioned city in the Bible. A lot of people will probably be surprised by that.
Yeah.
And plays a central role, of course, in the story that you probably heard in Sunday school, the Tower of Babel and Nimrod. And Nimrod was considered an archetype of the Antichrist and the first ruler of what was, essentially a world government economic system and a cult-based religion. And then Babylon plays a central role. You'll read about it throughout, many books of the Bible. Old Testament plays a central role in the books of the prophets. You probably heard of, King Nebuchadnezzar and all those stories and Daniel. And then, reemerges in Revelation as Mystery Babylon and Babylon the Great. And so Bible scholars have puzzled over this reference that John makes to Mystery Babylon and Babylon the Great and asked what that is.
Hmm. So essentially, we've got three basic phases of Babylon. We've got the Babylon that emerges first at the Tower of Babel, Nimrod's Babylon. We've got the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar that destroyed the temple, and then the future mystery Babylon. And scholars are still not in agreement as to what or where that Babylon is located.
Yeah, there's been many different interpretations of what this final Babylon is. Some people believed it was a Roman Catholic Church. That was a predominant view for a long time in Protestant circles. And then in more recent decades, people have asked, could this Babylon be America? Could it be the European Union, Rome, or actually, Babylon in Iraq, modern day Iraq? Baghdad is located not too far from where Babylon originally was, and there's other various theories. The rise of these Middle Eastern powers, the ancient boundaries of Babylon actually encompasses what is sort of today's Middle East. Many different countries throughout the Middle East. So there's many different theories, and it's a very very intriguing topic. In our research for our book, The Babylon Code, some different scholars referred to it as the Bible's greatest mystery. So that's how we came up with the subtitle for the book, Solving the Bible's Greatest End Times Mystery.
Hmm. So what is it about Babylon historically that leads it to be so significant for our future? How is Babylon influencing the world today?
So the interesting thing we uncovered in the research, we interviewed over 100 different faith leaders and prophecy experts, everybody from, Billy Graham and Dr. Tim LaHaye to Hal Lindsey and Mark Hitchcock, Pastor Greg Laurie, Joel Rosenberg, Rabbi Kahn, and also many secular experts, Noam Chomsky and professors at Princeton and Oxford and different universities. And so as we dug into this, we discovered that much of what's happening today has its roots in ancient Babylon. And so in ancient Babylon, there was an attempt to, and throughout history, there's been attempts by many world rulers to try to, unite the world together into a global system, a global government or a economic system, religion. And you've seen this, you know, many different, you know, dictators throughout history, you know, Genghis Khan and Nebuchadnezzar and Caesar and, you know, Hitler and Chairman Mao and different people throughout history who have attempted to, you know, consolidate their power. And so, you know, Babylon was the first attempt to create this global system in opposition to what God instructed us. And then today, with today's globalism and the push for global governance, and, you know, just recently in New York, the United Nations had a big summit, and afterwards they had a global citizen festival, and they had celebrities coming there. So they're trying to get us to think in terms of ourselves as global citizens. So there's sort of a more subtle push that's going on now, but it all had its roots in ancient Babylon.
Hmm. Now, historically, we see it in the record, and many, of course, in the academic community, the archaeologists who've done the digs aren't going to tie this necessarily to the biblical narrative, the spiritual implications, but the city that was identified in the Bible as the seat of Nimrod's kingdom, in the Bible it's spelled E-R-E-C-H, Erech, which is essentially the name that was given to the country after the Sykes-Picot Agreement after World War I, Iraq. The name persisted throughout history for some reason, but when archaeologists began digging and comparing pottery styles and other artifacts that were discovered around the ancient Near East, around Mesopotamia, they found that that city, Erech, had colonies and had conducted military campaigns as far away as Turkey, Armenia, halfway across Iran. So 3500 BC, this city-state on the which at the time would have been on the coast of the Persian Gulf, the shoreline has receded some in the last 5,000 years, was literally out there conquering the known world at that time. There's also some evidence to suggest that they may have founded the first dynasty of Egypt, but professional Egyptologists don't like to go there because it's considered an insult that their culture actually stemmed from invading Sumerians. But again, we've got the evidence there, and somebody with a biblical worldview can point to that and say, yeah, this tracks with what we read about Nimrod, because even though the Bible doesn't say much, it does say that he extended his kingdom to Assyria, where he founded Nineveh. And even later in the Bible, 2,000 years later, Assyria was called the land of Nimrod. How, you know, looking at the spiritual influence that's come down through the generations from Nimrod, how is that manifesting today in real concrete forms? I mean, you mentioned the Global Citizen Day, but what other ways are we seeing the influence of this shadowy character in the modern world?
Yeah, so one of the more interesting things about, you know, Nimrod and ancient Babylon, this original manifestation of Babylon, and of course, you know, Babylon throughout the Bible is sort of like the city in opposition against God, you know, in rebellion against God. It's the, you know, megapolis of rebellion and sin and the city of the devil, essentially. And as opposed to that, Jerusalem is the city of God and the city of heaven. And so there's these two contrasting cities, you know, sort of good and evil in a way that's, you know, plays out throughout the entire Bible, does this full arc. And part of the big reason why Babylon has this reputation is because Nimrod, and, you know, if there was a, if he did have a wife or a mom named Semiramis, that's not in the Bible, but it's a lot of extra biblical sources talk about her. You know, this would have been the origin of an occult-based religious system, you know, astrology and occultism and, you know, channeling and divination and sorcery and all that kind of stuff would have originated back in ancient Babylon, whenever that, you know, that first Babylon emerged. And so, you know, there's a religious, there's a spiritual aspect to this. So with the, you know, the rise of, you know, Satanism and the occult and, you know, interest in the supernatural in recent decades, we're seeing essentially a return of Mystery Babylon, or a return of this ancient occult-based religious system, this satanic system in opposition to God. So that's the spiritual basis for all this.
Hmm. Yeah, we've been seeing it in some strange ways. Where, for example, the European Parliament building is based on the artistic representations of the Tower of Babel. We've also seen at the Olympics, and I believe it was the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, where they had a very bizarre closing ceremony. And I forget if it was closing or opening ceremony, but one of the big ceremonies with all of the athletes participating in something that looked very much like the artistic representation of the Tower of Babel. So even though we don't know very much about him, what we're finding is that down through history, what people think they remember about him, or perhaps secrets that have been preserved through various societies or religious orders have preserved about Nimrod, is still influencing not just various forms of spiritual belief, but also government. And again, the European Parliament building being an example of that. I've also written a paper a couple of years ago in which I traced the influence, or the veneration, rather, of Nimrod by the highest orders of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which again seems really odd for an organization that at least one, I've known a couple of members that have tried to make the case to me that it's a Christian organization, you know, guys that I respected and liked, you know, friends of mine, but I had to disagree. You know, how can you be a Christian organization and venerate this guy at the 32nd and 33rd degree, the highest degrees in your order? That doesn't make any sense to me. You mentioned early on in the book, some of the research you collected for the Babylon Code, that there are people of money, people of wealth, old royal families in Europe that trace themselves back to Nimrod. And I have to ask the same question there. Why would political leaders, or people who believe they've got a divine right to rule, perhaps, trace their ancestry back to this particular character?
Yeah, this was a very, you know, fascinating finding in the research for the book. And, you know, I'm an investigative reporter. I used to work at the Los Angeles Daily News, and, you know, I was recently the editor of Charisma magazine. And so, and then my co-author, Paul McGuire, is a prophecy expert and an author, and he used to have the nationally syndicated Paul McGuire show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought by combining our sort of skill set and knowledge together, you know, he spent decades, you know, investigating the Bilderberg Group and the Freemasonry and the Illuminati and Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and these different secret societies and how it connects with Bible prophecy and what's happening today. And so we tried to bring a higher standard of credibility and scholarship to the topic. So all the sources we cite throughout the book, you know, in addition to all these many interviews, we stick with mainstream sources, you know, articles in the Washington Post and mainstream media, or papers from, you know, prestigious universities and studies and government documents. And so if you read to the end, that, you know, the footnotes, you'll find all these mainstream sources. So I wanted to make the book as credible as possible, because, you know, this is a very highly controversial topic. And so I wanted to, you know, what is the truth here, and really dig into this. And so, you know, so some of the things we found is that there are, you know, supposedly there's these 13, you know, families that are the, you know, purportedly the Illuminati families.
Right, right.
And one of the most predominant ones is the Rothschild family. So, you know, supposedly is part of this. And they, you know, they, you know, claim to trace their ancestry back to Nimrod, you know, which is very intriguing. And so the idea is that, you know, this sort of this occult knowledge, this knowledge of how this, you know, system of government works in the world and control and you know, which has spiritual roots, has been passed down from, you know, generation to generation through these secret societies, these clandestine organizations that, you know, began in ancient Babylon, you know, were passed down to Egypt and then to Greece and to Rome and then, on to Europe eventually, and then, you know, to America ultimately. And some of these, you know, the ones you probably heard of, you know, which I just mentioned, be like, you know, Yale University Skull and Bone,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of our presidents and secretary of states, many of the movers and shakers of the world that belong to that particular one. And some of the research we did, you know, showed that they may have roots in the Bavarian Illuminati, you know, secret society that, you know, first emerged in the late 1700s in Germany. In fact, one of my ancestors, Friedrich von Schiller, he's the poet that wrote Ode to Joy.
Oh, yeah.
Beethoven set the music in the Ninth Symphony. He wrote some famous plays of William Tell and Don Carlos, which George Lucas cited as an influence in Star Wars. Many of his friends were members of the Bavarian Illuminati in the late 1700s, and they actually, one member of the Illuminati actually paid off his debts and gave him a place to live for several years. And that's when he wrote Ode to Joy, which is now the anthem of the European Union. and so he knew all these guys. And his play, The Robbers, played a role in the, you know, helped inspire the French Revolution. And then afterwards, he became really disillusioned after he saw the carnage of the French Revolution, and he started to find out more about what was going on. And then towards the end of his life, he was actually writing a play to expose them. You know, he was writing this play to, you know, reveal the plans of the Illuminati to overthrow the governments of the Europe and abolish Christianity. And then he died mysteriously. And there was widespread rumors at the time he was poisoned with arsenic, and then he was hastily buried in the middle of the night. And so when I was a little boy, my grandma, you know, she told me about some of this stuff and said there was some mystery about him and encouraged me to follow in his footsteps. And I discovered more about this as a reporter at the LA Daily News back in 2009. And I met Paul doing some research into this, and that sort of began this whole journey to investigate this whole thing. So, you know, there's these, you know, these old groups that have passed down this occult knowledge and, you know, how to, you know, essentially how to run the world kind of, you know, information. And now we're seeing, you know, these groups becoming much more, I guess, blatant in their symbolism. So, you know, like you mentioned with the Olympics just a few years ago, they actually sang a song called Nimrod. That was one of the key songs. I mentioned that in the book. And I mean, if you watch any Super Bowl or Grammy Awards or any of these things, you see all kinds of this Illuminati kind of symbolism, music videos. It's very predominant there nowadays, and movies. And it's just, you know, if you really start digging into it, it's just sort of mind boggling how widespread this is today. And so we assembled the best evidence possible to, you know, sort of show that this is sort of the real history of the world and this, you know, mysterious link to ancient Babylon.
Hmm. Yeah, it is getting really in your face. And, of course, the song Nimrod was performed at the 2012 London Olympics.
That's what it was, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry?
Yeah, that's what it was, the London Olympics.
Right. So yeah, it is becoming much more open, as though they're no longer concerned about anybody pointing a finger at it. Whereas generations past, our ancestors may have been a little more theologically aware or spiritually aware as to what was going on, may have complained or at least rejected this, you know, these very overt messages that are being sent through events like this, which you might be able to build a good case are actual magical workings. What is the end game for these secret societies? You know, reading the works of people like Manly P. Hall and other writers who have produced bodies of work focused on this sort of, this sort of, paranormal study, the works of Blavatsky and Crowley and other devotees who are digging into a work that's culminated in the modern New Age movement, let's put it that way, looking for alternate forms of spirituality, direct contact with the spirit realm. We've even got scientific organizations like the Institute for Noetic Sciences, co-founded by just the recently deceased astronaut Edgar Mitchell, to try to find scientific ways to contact and quantify and somehow measure the existence of the supernatural realm. What are these secret societies trying to accomplish?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would imagine that, you know, for many of these people, it's a very noble pursuit in their minds. You know, they, of course, you know, if it was possible to bring about global peace, if we could, you know, eliminate nuclear weapons and wars and help alleviate hunger and poverty and suffering in the world, yeah, sure, that'd be a wonderful thing. But, you know, we live in the real world and, you know, God told us, in the Bible, you know, he set up the system to have, you know, different nations. And there's a very, you know, specific reason for that is that, you know, it sets up sort of a system of checks and balances. You can't have, you know, one person become a, you know, a tyrant or a global dictator and cause, you know, even more suffering. So, you know, I mean, this whole globalism movement, you know, it's an ancient, ambition of humanity. We want to be our own gods. We want to create our own, you know, utopian world. And apart from God, we don't want to, abide by the rules that God has set in place for us. And so, you know, when we see this reemerging today, and many people, you know, believe that this would be the solution to many of the world's problems, if we could create some kind of global system. And that's, you know, that's what many organizations are embarking on now, the United Nations and World Bank and, you know, different governments. And, you know, we talk about in one of the chapters, there's actually all kinds of federalist organizations in Europe and even here in America that are actually openly working towards the creation of a world government. They've drafted world constitutions. And they think that this would be a very good thing. But the problem is that the Bible tells us that, you know, at some point in history, maybe soon, because we see a lot of these things sort of coming, sort of converging together now, is that, you know, this system will sort of be slowly put into place, which is what we see now. And then at some point, this diabolical figure, the Antichrist, who will, be behind some great deception that will deceive, you know, the Bible mentions even the very elect of God, will, you know, take the reins of world power. And so the great danger here, and why we really want to get this message out through this book, and, you know, and we're beginning to work on a film now.
Oh, really?
The Bible tells us that when this figure, the Antichrist and the false prophet, when they do indeed take control of this global system, that ultimately, it's anywhere from, you know, more than 3/4 of the world's population will die, you know, through war and famine and disease and poverty and, you know, just the whole gamut. So by the time of this, you know, what the Bible talks about is a 7-year tribulation, you know, the vast majority of humanity will die. So, I mean, this is a tragedy of unimaginable proportions that, you know, the Bible tells us it will happen. And many prophecies in the Bible were made about Jesus' first coming. And, you know, pretty much, you know, Bible scholars agree that all those prophecies have come true. So, you know, we talked about in the book that, you know, if this were logical, if all the prophecies of Jesus' first coming and many other prophecies in the Bible have come true, we're now seeing maybe, you know, in partial fulfillment today, then, you know, it just stands to reason that the final ones will come true too. So, if this is the case, you know, this is, you know, I'm a reporter, and I recognize early on that this is, you know, one of the biggest stories in the world, that they're in the process of creating the system, and then ultimately, this is what it'll lead to. So we want to wake people up. We want to wake the church up, because there's still time at this point to, turn back to God and appeal to our Maker, who knows? I mean, it's God's prerogative, but maybe this could be, you know, delayed or.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the hope here.
Give people more time to hear the gospel message and be brought into the kingdom before the restrainer is pulled away, and the man of sin, the man of lawlessness, let loose to do his work.
Right.
Yeah, I was trying to remember desperately what that thing at the closing ceremony in 2008 looked like, and I was right. I did remember it correctly. It was very much like a Babylonian ziggurat, the closing ceremony of the Beijing Olympics. And of course, there was something similar to that, but it looked more organic at the London Olympics 4 years later, almost as though it were a tower made of turf, which sort of it looks like some of the megalithic sites in Britain that date back to the Stone Age, the era of Stonehenge. But for some reason, they keep coming back to that Babel symbolism, which, again, more evidence that Nimrod and the world system that he tried to created temporarily, five millennia ago, is still having influence on the thought and political aspirations, spiritual aspirations of many globalists today. In your research, did you run across a common theme? Are they really trying to get us back to Babel?
Well, here was something very intriguing in the research for this, is that Oxford, there's several prestigious universities that have actually created institutes to study the potential end of human civilization, including Oxford, MIT, and a couple others of that caliber.
Mm-hmm.
And Oxford, you know, because they're concerned about global warming and nuclear war and things of that nature. But Oxford released a report, and it lists the 10, you know, primary risks to the future of human civilization. And they listed things like, you know, nuclear war and extreme climate change. They listed some kind of, you know, horrible pandemic, you know, asteroid impact, things of that nature. But the most interesting ones, they listed a global totalitarian government or a world dictatorship as one of the top 10 threats, you know, facing humanity. So, you know, these are very, smart guys. Nick Bostrom is, you may have heard about him with his work in artificial intelligence and the singularity and things like that. He's the head of this institute at Oxford, and they released this report. So, you know, people that are in the know and, you know, that, you know, understand what is really going on are concerned about this possibility. And so I think it's something that we need to take seriously. And, you know, another surprising finding in the research is the University of Chicago had taken an interest in this topic, and they did some polling, and they found that 51% of Americans believe a so-called secret cabal actually runs the world. And so, you know, many people, when they hear the word conspiracy theory, they may think there's some, you know, small fringe, you know, segment of the population that believes in these kind of things. But, you know, the University of Chicago did a poll and found over half of Americans believe this is how the world really works. So there's quite a bit to this, and there's a, you know, we cite all kinds of different, you know, sources of that nature in the book and all kinds of interviews. And so we hope that this will help, you know, wake up people to what's happening and maybe even build a movement to do something about this and ultimately to inspire people to turn back to God and get right with the Lord. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a spiritual war that we're facing, and so our weapons are prayer and fasting rather than guns or even the ballot box, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
The surveys showing that the majority of Americans believe that there's a secret group that runs the world. That is interesting, but I'm curious as to what hard evidence there might be to support that theory. In your research, the interviews you conducted, did you discover any evidence of collusion amongst, say, global political leaders, financial leaders, bankers, military leaders that would indicate that they are trying to collaborate and move us all in a certain direction, with the ultimate end being the return to Babylon?
I think if you take all the evidence that we assemble in the book as a whole, while there's no smoking gun, we don't have any, you know, admissions from, you know, high-ranking government officials that, you know, this is their secret plan kind of thing. But if you take the evidence as a whole and you put it together, you know, it the logical conclusion is that, you know, almost everybody that's read the book so far, I mean, nobody's like, you know, gotten a hold of me and said, oh, this is just a bunch of hooey-pooey and, you know, we don't believe this. Everybody that's read the book has came to the conclusion that, yes, you know, you've assembled, you know, very strong and convincing arguments and I guess, you know, circumstantial evidence that this is what's really going on sort of behind the scenes. In the next book, in the film, we're going to dig deeper into these, you know, these secret societies and what their ultimate goals and plans are. And there's many different websites out there that openly talk about sort of, you know, this, you know, push for a global system and, you know, there's many different think tanks and United Nations websites and different foundations, and they openly talk about this law schools. You know, part of what we've seen happen in recent years is, you know, you've had all these different trade treaties, changes in international laws that sort of reduce the sovereignty of the United States and other countries. You know, we just had this global sustainable development summit in New York, you know, where the United Nations adopted this 2030 agenda for sustainable development. Many people believe that that's just sort of another step towards this system. That's sort of a code word that's used, a euphemism for, you know, distribution of wealth and climate change and that kind of thing to bring the world together. And then you had the climate change treaty in Paris in December, where the nations of the world agreed to, take steps to adopt that. So it's another example of, you know, world governments coming together to address climate change. That's sort of a rallying cause for this whole movement. Then there's various, trade treaties and things like that. So there's all these sort of little incremental steps that have been going on for decades now to sort of put this infrastructure into place. And, you know, it's in the headlines and it's in the media, and you just sort of put it all together and then, you know, begins to make far more sense of what's really happening here.
And because the type of activity that you're describing requires cooperation that extends across national boundary lines, the elimination of nationalism, the encouragement of a globalist worldview among children and young people through education would be really important in bringing this to fruition, would it not?
Yeah, I mean that's part of what's happening here. So that, you know, like when they had this United Nations summit back in September, you know, they had the Global Citizens Festival accompanying that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for many years now, there's actually a, you know, like part of the Common Core, you probably heard about that, this new curriculum in the schools, and they do. They try to encourage the children to think of themselves as a sort of global citizens, and, you know, we need to protect the environment and address climate change, and, you know, everybody working together, we can have a more peaceful world. And so for children, this all makes, you know, perfect sense, and it seems like a good thing. And so there's sort of this indoctrination that's going on, because, you know, I mean, throughout history, every big kid that's ever existed knew there's, you know, a couple of primary ways in which you control a population. First of all, you want to sort of indoctrinate the kids. You want to control the media, which, you know, there's now just a few corporations that control all the mainstream media. I used to be a reporter at mainstream media outlets. So most of what we, you know, hear from the mainstream media and even through, you know, movies and TV, it's all sort of, controlled. One of the guys I interviewed for the book is Jim Mars. You may have heard about him.
Yeah.
He's a New York Times bestselling author. He wrote Rule by Secrecy, and he delved into this topic in a number of different books, but, you know, not from a Christian point of view. But I asked him about this, and he said when he was working as an investigative reporter at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram many decades ago, he became curious about why was the CIA having a major ownership of one of the newspapers in his chain? And then it turned out that he discovered that, these intelligence agencies have people are embedded at, you know, major media outlets to sort of make sure they stay in line. You know, they don't sort of, you know, jump outside the lines kind of deal. And then I read Rule by Secrecy when I was a reporter at the LA Daily News. So one day, I was probably like, you know, early 30s, I asked my editor, I go, hey, did you hear about this? I read this book, and they claim the media consolidation, and there's these, you know, secret societies and the Rothschilds. And she goes, shh, we don't talk about that. That's crazy talk. You know? And so, so if you're a reporter and you want to really dig into what's really happening, you'll be discouraged from looking into it. And, so that helps sort of perpetuate this illusion that everybody sort of accepts as reality. But, you know, in truth, there's far more going on. And that's what we try to reveal it in the Babylon Code.
Yes. When you put on those glasses, like in the movie They Live, you know, Roddy Piper and Keith David.
Oh, yeah.
You put on those sunglasses and suddenly you see the aliens all around you. You cannot unsee it. All of a sudden, the scales fall from your eyes, and you realize that there's more going on out there than what you were told in the official histories.
Exactly.
The identity of the third Babylon, seeing as how this is the one that still lies before us, we kind of touched on this a little bit. There are folks that I've interviewed here in recent months that have differing opinions on the identity of the final Babylon. You, in your book, describe the long-running spiritual war as the battle between Babylon and Jerusalem. How do you identify Babylon? Is it a physical place, or is it a spiritual system, or some combination of both?
Yeah, that's the conclusion that we come to, is that it's a combination of all these things. It's, you know, there's geopolitical, military Babylon, and then, you know, there's also economic Babylon, and then religious Babylon. And so just like today we refer to Hollywood. We're not talking about the actual town of Hollywood in Los Angeles. We're referring to the entertainment industry.
Right.
Or if you say Wall Street, you're not actually talking about the street in New York. You're talking about the global financial system that's based out of, well, largely based out of New York and the stock markets. And so I think, you know, when the biblical writers, when John and others, you know, wrote about Babylon, you know, throughout the Bible, you know, you had to be sort of careful in what you're saying. So, you know, what we believe is sort of a code word or a prophetic mystery. And so, you know, we essentially believe that, you know, Mystery Babylon and Babylon the Great is this global system that has its roots in ancient Babylon. It's now reemerging, rising today. The spirit of Babylon is rising again. And we're witnessing the reemergence of this ancient, you know, cult-based geopolitical economic system. You know, the Bible talks about, you know, that without the mark of the beast, whatever that is, you won't be able to buy or sell. So once the Antichrist, you know, consolidates power and takes over, you won't be able to, you know, hold a job. You won't be able to buy things. You won't be able to participate in the economic system. So this whole system underneath the Antichrist, this Babylonian system, you know, it's political, it's economic, and then it's, you know, religious. You know, ultimately the Antichrist will require everybody to worship him, or you'll face beheading, the Bible talks about. So that's what we think it is. And we think it'll have probably multiple, centers, you know, so, you know, Washington DC could be maybe the, you know, the geopolitical head of it, you know, the political aspect, and maybe, you know, the city of London is the economic head, or Wall Street is, and then, you know, maybe, you know, the actual, you know, Iraq, the original boundaries of Babylon, maybe that plays some role too. You know, so I think it'll probably have multiple centers, but then there's also the intriguing reference of, you know, this in Revelation, I think it's 18, refers to Babylon being this mighty city that's destroyed in 1 hour, and that the merchants of the world will sit from afar in their ships and watch her burning, and all this great wealth destroyed in 1 hour. So it seems to refer to some kind of nuclear attack, and so, you know, a lot of people have thought that was America, and, you know, very well could be that there could, you know, many scriptures have, you know, multiple, you know, many prophecies have multiple meanings, and so, you know, we think that's a possibility, and that's sort of the way we look at it.
We had tossed out a couple of names of the more prominent secret societies of history: the Freemasons, the Illuminati. You write early in the book, The Babylon Code, that secret societies with roots in mystery religions of the Tower of Babel are setting the stage for the fulfillment of end times prophecies. In your research, what secret societies kept coming up and maybe playing key roles in this end times endgame?
Yeah. So a lot of people probably don't know this, but there's always been secret societies that are, you know, sort of occult-based ones that are, you know, very well connected to the centers of power. So even in Egypt and Rome and Greece, these ancient secret societies existed under many different names over thousands of years. And of course, what connects us all together, you know, there's no way there's no way it's humanly possible for people, you know, continue on and be passed down like this and all be interconnected. It's a spiritual, I mean, you know, in the background, this is a demonic system. This is a satanic system. That's why, you know, it can make sense, you know, from that standpoint. But, you know, even like, you know, Plato and Aristotle, they referred to, the mystery schools. You probably heard that term
mm-hmm.
that existed at that time. And so there's always been this close connection between the rulers and the, the wizards, the soothsayers, the sorcerers and the astrologers, sort of your occult religious powers. And then also the military. So these are the predominant ways that, the satanic system, maintains control and power and wealth and is able to, pass this down over, many thousands of years.
That's interesting you mention it, the occult military complex. Somebody just sent me one of the interesting things that's occurred to me since coming to work with Tom Horn at Skywatch TV is, I get unsolicited stuff by mail a lot more often than I used to when I was just doing this podcast and Sharon and I were doing our podcast together, PID Radio. But somebody just sent me a number of Xeroxed pages from a book that is purports to be a history of the military occult complex. So now I'm going to have to pull that out and read that too, along with your book here.
I've heard about those connections before. In fact, I think it was shortly after the book came out, my co-author, Paul McGuire, he's been contacted by some, very high-level military people who have, read the book. And one of them, took quite an interest in this. We can't disclose any names or anything.
But sure.
This guy has, an extensive occult background. And so there's this connection between the occult and government and the military this dates back to the Bible. If you read like the book of Daniel, they'll talk about the king and his soothsayers and his sorcerers and that kind of thing. So this is you're not going to read this in your American history book.
No,
there's this long history of these connections that go way back and people at the higher levels they're fully aware of this and know how this works. And yeah, so it's just if you've never heard about this kind of stuff before, it's pretty mind-blowing. I mean, you start discovering, what's really happening.
It's something that we've been aware of for a while because you start digging into American military history since World War II through the works of people like Jim Mars or Peter LaVenda, you find out pretty quickly that the United States government has spent a lot of money trying to weaponize the occult. In fact, just recently I spoke to a retired physicist, Lambert Dolphin, who is a wonderful Christian man whose website has been a great resource. Well, in fact, he's got a lot of articles and essays posted at his site about Nimrod and Babel and was very influential.
Oh, is that right?
Oh yeah, ldolphin.org. You want to take a look at that and check that out because he's got a lot of stuff there that was very helpful to me 15 years ago when I first began to realize that there was more to the spirit realm than what I was hearing about at church on Sunday mornings. But he was at the Stanford Research Institute at a time when the government had contracted SRI to research remote viewing. And so, I had to ask him, as a Christian man, how did you rationalize going into work every day where they were trying to figure out ways to get people demonically possessed, basically? And he said, well, that wasn't in my area of, thankfully. but yeah, he was, he knew it was going on and was not really comfortable with it. It's something that's been ongoing in the United States at least since 1945. And they're probably, if we did some more digging, we could probably argue that it goes a lot further than that. The sense you come away with when you start reading about these connections is that all over the world, throughout time, every government has had its own mages and sorcerers trying to hex the enemies of the state. And the modern United States is no exception to that. Mm-hmm. The final takeaway from the book, Troy, what do you hope that Christian readers, well, any reader who may not be familiar with the idea that there is a deep state, if you will, that crosses national boundary lines, a global state, if you will, of secret societies, occultists that are seeking to recreate the kingdom of Nimrod. What do you hope people take away from the book?
Well, if you're hearing this for the first time, it may be a little, disconcerting.
Overwhelming, almost. Yeah.
Overwhelming, may cause some fear, but that's not the purpose of why we wrote this book. I mean, the purpose is we wanted to wake people up so that they're aware of what's happening. And I mean, probably you know, I interviewed Billy Graham, you know, for this book, and you know, he said that the signs of the end of the age are converging for the first time since Jesus made those predictions. But then he, about the same time, he issued an open letter to America. It was called Open Letter to America and the Deceived People. So he recognized this. And what he did is he compared America to ancient Nineveh. Hmm. And so when God, you probably heard the story of Jonah the whale. When God sent Jonah to Nineveh, he sent him there to warn Nineveh that it was going to be destroyed for its wickedness. And of course, you know, Jonah didn't want to go because the Assyrians were a very fearful people and known for terrible atrocities and such. But Jonah did. He obeyed God and he eventually went to Nineveh and he warned them, and they took the warning and they repented and they turned to God. And then, you know, the judgment that was coming was essentially delayed and averted. And so Billy Graham, you know, told me that he believed the same thing can happen today. And so there's many people that are very hopeful that if, you know, people can wake up and sort of take the blinders off and recognize what's really happening, that, you know, many people will turn back to God or turn to God, repent, and that, you know, this prophetic scenario we see in the initial stages of it emerging now would essentially be averted or delayed. And so there's a growing movement of people that believe that there could be an end times great awakening as more people wake up to what's happening and realize that, you know, time is probably short. And in fact, my co-author Paul McGuire, he had a vision, I think it was in July 2012, and he foresaw a spiritual awakening beginning on the west coast of America and spreading across the country and then eventually throughout the world. And there's, you know, this sort of controversial, but there's various verses in the Bible that speak of a potential, last great spiritual awakening that'll occur before all this happens. And so that's what we're hoping will happen. That's what we hope this book will inspire people to, you know, the time is short. We need to be doing what we should be doing. We need to, you know, if you haven't, if you haven't accepted Jesus into your heart, it would be, good to consider that. Mm-hmm. and to go to church, to read the Bible. And, I just thought it was very important. I interviewed Billy Graham and Hal Lindsey and many different prominent faith leaders. And this is, the overwhelming consensus among all these faith leaders is that, yes, we're in the run-up to these end-time events predicted by the prophets. And so I felt it was very important to get this message out there. And, of course, Billy Graham's like 97 now or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Many of these guys are very old. And so I did, as a journalist, I felt it was incumbent upon me to try to get this message out. And that's what we're trying to do.
Well, the book, The Babylon Code, Troy Anderson and his co-author Paul McGuire found the book recommended by the likes of Dr. Tim LaHaye, Dr. Thomas Horn. Hey, I know him. Michael Snyder, a publisher of the Economic Collapse blog. Jonathan Bernice, Hugh Ross, Michael Youssef, Jan Markell, Pat Boone even. So a variety of people from a variety of backgrounds. Jack Hayford, well-known pastor, all recommending the book, The Babylon Code. And again, I'm still in the early stages of it, but based on some work that I'm doing right now, plan to dig in and try to get through it this weekend, because it's going to touch on some things that have spurred my curiosity and finally got me writing again after a long, long time. Troy, appreciate your work and appreciate you applying the diligence and the skills of a journalist to this topic, because too often this subject is approached with less than journalistic rigor, shall we say, and sometimes conclusions are reached that find themselves stranded, isolated from the evidence. So I appreciate that. The early chapters have got me intrigued, and I will make a point of getting this finished here this weekend.
Thank you very much. And, I appreciate that.
Well, and please let us know when the film gets close to completion, because having talked with Paul on a number of occasions and always finding the conversations with him to be really fascinating, enjoyed the conversation with you and the conversations that we had when you were here last fall. We certainly look forward to doing it again and helping you get the word out.
That sounds great.
Check the show notes at vftb.net for a link to where you can get a copy of The Babylon Code by Troy Anderson and Paul McGuire. And, of course, Paul will be one of the featured speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference coming up in July. The conference itself is sold out, but live streaming is now available, and there are a couple different packages available where you can stream just the presentations in the main ballroom or the presentations in just the Aspen Room, which is the largest of the breakout rooms at the Colorado Springs Marriott, the Pikes Peak Marriott. But if you do both, you get a discount. And so, and because they're going to archive the presentations online for 6 weeks this year instead of just four, you'll have more time to go back and view the presentations that require multiple views to absorb the information. And I'm sure there will be several of those at least, or just more time to watch them at your convenience, or invite friends over and have a prophecy conference watching party. You'll get more information online at prophecywatchers.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Interesting stuff. And as we approach what appears to be the end of days, I mean, the world is apparently standing on its head. Right is wrong, bad is good, men or women, or none of the above. And it's just, it seems every week brings something new to challenge what we thought we knew about the nature of reality, because apparently the way we've been living for the last 8,000 years just isn't good enough according to the God of this world, of course. So just setting aside all the cultural stuff and just looking at news headlines, as I'm recording this on the afternoon of Sunday the 13th, word has come within the last couple of hours of a powerful car bomb in Ankara, Turkey, which has killed at least 27 people. Dozens more are injured. We'll have more to say about that tomorrow on Skywatch TV as we take a look at the aftermath of this. It will be telling, I think, who claims responsibility for this or who the government of Turkey and who the government of Turkey chooses to blame for this, because it is possible, at least, that this is related to Turkey's intervention and what's going on in Syria. Could be ISIS, could be the Kurds. It could be neither, but could be blamed on either ISIS or the Kurds by the Turkish government. You know how that goes. Never let a good crisis go to waste. So we'll have more to say about that tomorrow. Other interesting things that have popped up over the last week or so. This one, I think, is significant, not in terms of the specific impact on claiming human life, but just because it is a tell regarding the mindset of most of academia. An online academic journal called PLOS One, PLOS One, which is an open journal. It's a pay for play model. You do pay to get access to it, but they do go through a peer review process. Published an article in January that was produced by several Chinese scientists. Translated, the title was Biomechanical Characteristics of Hand Coordination in grasping Activities of Daily Living. The article made the point that the human hand is so complex that it is evidence of a brilliant design by a creator. Now, the authors of the piece say that in translating to English, it conveys more of a sense of God as a creator than they had perhaps intended, that their point was perhaps that nature allowed us to evolve this wonderfully complex design, because there are all kinds of actions, motions that we carry out with our hands that we do, for the most of us, you know, just second nature. Grasping, simple things like getting your keys out of your pocket and opening a door with one hand, you know, while you're balancing a bag of groceries in the other or whatever. The process of taking a pen in hand and writing, you know, just simple things we take for granted, don't even think about, are beyond the capability of the most modern and complex robots. And so this team of Chinese researchers made that point. Said the hand is a marvelously designed machine. But because the references to a creator were in the article, even after it was published at PLOS ONE, the editors went back and withdrew the article from publication and published a retraction. And I quote, "The editors apologized to readers for the inappropriate language in the article and the errors during the evaluation process," end quote. Inappropriate language that slipped through because of errors during the evaluation process. John Haller, in his weekly prophecy update last week, March 6th, made a really good point about this. This may be a case where God blinded the editors at this academic journal just long enough to let this slip through for them to reveal their bias. I mean, the fact that we cannot design a machine to do anything like what the human hand does indicates the incredible complexity of the design that goes into the human hand. But saying so in an academic journal is inappropriate. Speaking of machines, yesterday, March 12th, an artificial intelligence created by Google scored a 3-0 victory in a man versus machine face-off over a Chinese board game called Go. The program called AlphaGo, because as you know, Google's parent company is no longer called Google, it is Alphabet. This artificial intelligence defeated a Go grandmaster, Li Sedol. And experts who are watching this says, you know, this is interesting, but what it really shows is that the state of artificial intelligence is farther along than anybody thought. Go is apparently a very complex game. I know nothing about it. But it was considered to be the ultimate test, as far as board games go, for an artificial intelligence. And experts believe that it was at least 10 years away from being able to do what AlphaGo did yesterday, defeating a Go grandmaster, 3 games out of 3. Stuart Russell of the University of Cal Berkeley, he's in the Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences Department, said, "The fact that AI methods are progressing much faster than expected makes the question of the long-term outcome more urgent. It will be necessary to develop an entirely new discipline of research in order to ensure that increasingly powerful AI systems remain completely under human control. There is a lot of work to do." End quote. Yeah, that's kind of what those of us who have been talking about the transhumanist movement have been saying, that artificial intelligence could potentially pose an existential threat to humanity. In fact, transhumanists, who are part of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, people like Nick Bostrom and Stuart Armstrong have been warning about this as well, although they say we ought to keep on doing the research into artificial intelligence. So a little yellow flag here from the sidelines saying, hey, this is closer to becoming a reality than even the experts thought. And, you know, people rushing to and fro, knowledge will increase, just as the prophet Daniel said 2,500 years ago, 2,600 years ago. So something we will no doubt talk about on Sci Friday, this coming Friday on Skywatch TV. Every now and then we hear a new story from a different area about a strange rumbling or hum, a mechanical sound that nobody can pinpoint, can't locate the source. We've heard of the Fort Wayne, or it was, no, not Fort Wayne, the Kokomo hum. And then there's the Taos hum down in New Mexico. We've also heard reports from Bristol, England, and from Scandinavia. We got another one now from Windsor, Canada, which is just across the Detroit River from the city of Detroit. The Windsor hum has returned. Apparently, it's been on again and off again for years. But according to USA Today, the Windsor hum is back. Apparently, it's strong enough in Windsor that for some people it rattles dishes, windows, loud enough to keep people from sleeping. Disturbing thing. But again, nobody seems to be able to point out where exactly it's coming from. Mexico, a story that we reported on last year, back again, as Father Jose Antonio Fortea, who's an exorcist, Roman Catholic priest in Mexico, who last year ordered a mass exorcism of the entire country. is saying that they need to do it again because of a recent increase in satanic ritual killings. So the devil worship, the cult of Santa Muerte, which is depicted as a corpse wearing a bridal gown, which is creepy. I mean, creepy enough being a skeleton, even creepier that it's in a bridal gown, has led to an uptick there in ritual killings. The most recent, Edwin Juarez Palma, 24-year-old restaurant worker, found beaten, strangled, and with his neck slashed with a broken bottle. This done by the proponents of a vampire cult during a ceremony that was intended to turn him into a vampire. Yeah. Police said the young man was killed after being fooled into taking part in the initiation ceremony, the cult calling itself Sons of Baphomet. Well, we talked about this last year, talked about it with Dr. Michael Lake. I also talked about it with briefly with Reverend Dr. Robert Bennett. Is it possible to exorcise an entire nation? Well, not exactly. Not in the sense that you can literally drive them out. You can pray for the nation and pray for God's intervention, which in a sense has exorcistic qualities, but it's not like deliverance when you've got a demon that is possessing a person and you can cast them out. You can't necessarily cast them out of an entire territory. Now, having said that, there are aspects of worship, liturgy during church that have exorcistic qualities. House blessing, in a sense, is an exorcism of place. But can you do that for an entire nation? Probably not when you've got groups calling themselves the Sons of Baphomet operating within the nation's borders. Yes, prayer is good. Prayer is effective. But can you exorcise demons from an entire nation? I don't think so. But boy, oh boy, do we need to pray for our nation. All of us need to pray for our nations. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, a fascinating interview. I've finally got my courage up and contacted an Egyptologist by the name of David Rohl. That's R-O-H-L. He's featured in the film Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus. And filmmaker Tim Mahoney will be one of the speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference this July. If you haven't seen the film, Patterns of Evidence, you really should. You can order it through Amazon. You can also order it from the website, patternsofevidence.com. And you'll see David Rohl prominently featured in that film because it's Dr. Rohl's research that sort of realigns the timelines of history in the ancient Near East that are out of sync in the official history books. The reason that experts tell us there's no evidence for the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt is because they're looking in the wrong era. They're looking 300 years too early. Or 300 years too late, actually. They're trying to put the Israelites in the era of Pharaoh Ramses II, who actually was the pharaoh who raided the temple in Jerusalem during the reign of Solomon's son, Rehoboam. You got to go back several hundred more years, and you find that the pharaoh of the Exodus was it Thutmosis? Nope, no, I had it written down. Well, anyway, you'll hear that during the interview next week with David Rohl as he explains why the timelines are out of sync and shares some of the archaeological detective work that went into synchronizing things again so that we can see for ourselves that the history of Israel is available to us in the digs that have been done around Egypt and in Israel. Another reason that people said there was no evidence of the conquest, they were looking 300 years too late for the destruction layer at Jericho. When you resynchronize the timelines, the evidence is right there. So, March 20th, David Rohl on A View from the Bunker. Our Bible study this week, the Gilbert House Fellowship, two more studies, one New Testament, one Old Testament. The New Testament study this week, covering three of the more iconic events from the ministry of Jesus. Jesus walking on the water, Peter walking on the water. We also discuss why Matthew mentions Peter walking on the water, but Mark, who was Peter's disciple, doesn't mention it. Why is that? The feeding of the 5,000, which is actually feeding of 5,000 men. There were also women and children present, so it might have been, 10,000 people there, which makes that miracle even more astounding. And the beheading of John the Baptist at the request of what we know from outside sources was Salome, the daughter of Herodias, which rhymes with odious, which is what this act was, because not only was Herodias was the wife of Herod Antipas, who was the king who had John's head cut off. Herod Antipas was the son of Herod the Great. Herodias was the granddaughter of Herod the Great. And Salome, based on the word that Mark used to describe her, the word translated girl, was probably not more than 12 years old, a virgin. And yet she came out and danced that seductive dance for her great uncle and his banquet guests. So, yeah, that whole scene right there, it was distasteful and wrong on a lot of levels. Anyway, that's part of the New Testament study this week. The Old Testament study features Psalms and more chronology from 1 Chronicles. The early chapters of 1 Chronicles were going through the chronologies, or rather the genealogies of the tribes of Israel. And we discuss the prayer of Jabez, which is in there. So here our commentary on the prayer of Jabez. That's our Old Testament study this week, and you'll find both of those available for free download at gilberthouse.org. This week on Skywatch TV, we talk about the year 2016 with Tom Horn, author of the book Zenith 2016, and why so many so-called prophets and oracles throughout history have pointed to the period of time in which we are living right now as being significant. Will the Antichrist emerge this year? Will the rapture occur this year? Don't know. But for some reason, a variety of predictions have been made, Christian, pagan, and they all seem to point to this period of time. It's a fascinating discussion, and that will be the Skywatch TV program this week, available, let's see, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and in fact, it was even one broadcast early this morning as we welcome two new affiliates, WGGN Television and WLLA Television in Sandusky, Ohio and Kalamazoo, Michigan. Rather than read off all the dates and times of the program, I direct you to skywatchtv.com and then look in the top menu bar where it says channel listing. That includes all of the dates and times for the broadcast of Skywatch TV. The program will also be available as of tomorrow morning on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. Appreciate your likes on Facebook. Direct over there for comments and your questions and suggestions. Commentary about these programs. You'll find us there, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. And we appreciate your likes and reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find this particular podcast. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, and it's released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.